This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dream.
Bateman got 50 years. The father who gave away his daughters got life. All 11 co-defendants were convicted. The Netflix documentary then ends. But Short Creek doesn't. The FLDS doesn't. Warren Jeffs is reportedly still running the operation from a Texas prison cell. The same theology, the same obedience structure, the same isolation. It's all still there. This conversation is about the questions the doc raises and can't answer. Is any of this actually over? Here to do that, my co-host Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program with the FBI, and Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author of the book Nightbird, available wherever you get books. Also a survivor of extreme religiosity and a great resource on this topic. And in another hand that's being held out saying, I've survived this. You can too. I want to pick up where we left off in our last segment. Siobhan, you said never give up critical thinking. And that's such an important thing. Unfortunately, I feel like a lot of reason that people fall into cults is because people don't like critical thinking.
Right.
It takes work.
It takes work.
It takes effort. It takes thought. Sometimes it feels icky. But, you know, it's certainly a key to living a happy, successful, safe life. But again, it's something that not everybody is the greatest at. Okay, now Bateman's gone. Some still believe he's their leader from behind bars, too. But he's gone. That is the problem with communities like this. Warren Jeff's gone. These people, for them, a lot of them, have never practiced critical thinking. They have no reps in it. They have no muscle memory on it. That's what makes them such easy prey and made them such easy prey for a person like Bateman to step in. So how do you implant, how do you teach critical thinking to someone who's in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, or whatever, that has never had this demonstrated in front of them before? The thinking's already been done by the religious leader. And to do so is that's witchcraft. That's an evil sin.
Exactly, exactly. It's become an intergenerational way of life and the way of perceiving the world. So it's very intransigent to get through to folks like this. I think the only, well, I can't say for sure only way, maybe there are other ways, but having someone outside of the group, just as Christine Marie did in the documentary, someone make a heart-to-heart connection that feels safe. I loved the woman Julia in the documentary because she bonded with Christine. She could tell Christine really cared about her, and she started going over and kind of having secret conversations with her about the things that were bothering her. And Christine was one safe person she could talk to. And once she started talking to her, the floodgates opened. And her thinking just, which I think she was a smart woman, and she was really having to suppress a lot to stay in that group and to go along with Moroni, the husband. There's another red flag. Don't marry a man named Moroni. But I think that's probably the way out for so many of them, is having a connection with someone who's non-judgmental, who cares, but makes it safe to have those questions and to have those doubts and to listen and to, you know, sometimes just by opening that door for somebody who's in a cult like this, that can make the difference, rather than coming in, which would probably be my tendency. What the heck are you guys doing? This is all BS, right? Because I'm so out there with what I think. But Christine did a marvelous job of connecting and allowing a safe space for questions. And obviously not everybody bit the hook for that, but that one woman did. And that opened the door for getting enough information to the police and, you know, and busting the whole thing open.
Yeah, it seemed with Julia in the documentary that she, her love for her children overpowered her love of her religion.
Yes.
Which I found also interesting, because she even said it in the documentary that that it was at odds with her, really, because she really believed in this, and that she, I mean, she's very religious. She yeah. very much believed in FLDS. I wonder, would it have been, would she have had, do you think, the same reaction if she had been part of, what the hell did Warren Jeffs call his place in Texas?
Chuck E. Cheese. No,
it's you know where he moved everyone to there. I wonder if it, yeah. if she would have had the same reaction if Warren Jeffs, you know, plucked her daughter and gave it to him or someone else in that, or if it would just happen to be Samuel Bateman that kind of was the red flag for her. I wonder, because she did so devoutly believe in it, but she just couldn't bring herself to hand her daughter over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be good to know. She may have been someone that over time was able to think her own thoughts, and it just took a little bit of validation from Christine to make a movement. But it was still very hard for her because she had the belief of women are under the authority of their husbands, who's under the authority of the prophet, who's under the authority of the Heavenly Father, and their only goal was to obey, obey, obey. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying, you know, that leakage, you could see it started leaking in there somehow, that ability to interrogate information and be curious. You know, both for you, when you started having that same leakage, and for her, what do you think can inspire someone to start thinking? Because that's always the hardest part. What do you, any ideas on for her, but I know even for you?
Yeah, in my case, I had a phase, and I'd say it was 13 through 15, where I really tried to be devout. And that was when I got the idea that I just need to get married, and met the older man at church at 15 and was groomed and married at 16 and started having babies. So I was following the script that I was told. But certainly, I never completely lost my critical thinking. I tried to, because I wanted to be the good Christian wife. I tried to stop thinking. But it was really that the group I was in had such an emphasis on faith healing, and that if you just had faith and you prayed and the congregation prayed, that it would be healed. Anybody would be healed. And I was promised, I actually still have the little pamphlet, I found it recently, Childbirth Without Pain for Christian Women. And when I had my first baby at 16, I went in bragging that I wasn't going to have any pain. And surprise!
How'd that work out for you?
Yeah, after 24 hours of screaming.
And then you blame yourself because you must not have been praying enough.
Well, I caught at that point, there was some insight that somehow this did not all pull together. And then the next thing was my mother's cancer, my mother's death of cancer. I had been promised she would be healed. And then the little boy in the church with leukemia at age 5, and they promised he would not die. And then when he died, they said he'd be raised from the dead miraculously. None of that happened. And so I had enough of a mind to say, this smells fishy.
Because I remember you called the hotline.
I called the prayer hotline.
I remember that in the book. It was so. She called the prayer hotline, and this chick on the phone prays with you, and you're like, all right, it's all better now. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, your mother's healed. Go tell her to rise up and walk. And she was in a coma. She was brain dead, essentially in a coma. And I went over and I felt silly saying it out loud, but I said it in my mind, because God can read our thoughts, right? So I just, you know, come on, mom, raise up and walk. Didn't happen. And so I am just so grateful. I was always a reader, and I was in public school. So I was not isolated, and I was not surrounded by people who had these extreme beliefs. So I'm just so grateful for that.
Is that the key right there? Because I was going to ask, you know, okay, you had these things demonstrated to you that contradicted what you were told of what was going to happen. They're going to rise from the dead. This is mm-hmm. going to happen. I mean, there's no history of these things ever happening to anyone, but this is going to happen this time. And then it doesn't happen. And it happens over and over, and promises are made, and none of them ever come true in these mm-hmm. sort of situations. Mm-hmm. And critical thinkers get the hell out, because they go, mm-hmm. well, this is a line of crap. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But there's so many that don't. There's so many that just like, oh, well, they were wrong again. But, you know, it's the Lord's will. I mean, what is keeping people in these sort of isolation chambers? And maybe that is it right there, the isolation chambers of lies, of being let down time and time again, where we say it's going to happen, it's not going, it doesn't happen. Is isolation the key? That is my question. Yeah. Is isolation the key to keeping that belief system going? Because we see it in so many things, the Duggars, where it's like very insulated. We don't go to public school. We don't interact with society. We don't have jobs. We have our own businesses. Like everything is so isolated. So no information can come in that may say, "Woo, you might be wrong about this, Jim Bob." Right. And if you keep everybody together and nobody questions any of that, then I guess you kind of keep it. But eventually it cracks. We're in a world where it's insanely difficult to not have other information come in, unless you're really like this, like Bateman in the middle of the desert. I mean, that's the ultimate isolation. Is it that? Is it the isolation that keeps people faithful even when the promises fail?
Yeah. When people are surrounded by the dogma and the false beliefs and the thinking errors, and this is all they hear, and they believe that their eternal salvation depends on not asking questions. I do see a lot of people come to therapy after they've left groups like this, not always that high controlled, but they've left groups where mm-hmm. you know, they had been coerced and told to believe crazy things and give all their money. A lot of people do leave, and a lot of people are writing books about it now because they're coming out and discussing it. I didn't discuss my history with religion for 50 years, right. really, because I was embarrassed about it. Yeah. And I just got to an age where, you know, we're seeing so much of this, people are coming out and talking about it, and it's time. And, you know, I am a human being. I have made terrible mistakes in my life. There were reasons for it. And if other people can learn from my story and gain some sense of freedom and autonomy and develop into their better selves, then if I do even one person good, it's worth talking about it. So I'm too old to care about shame anymore. It is what it is.
Siobhan, what's the first, I'm sorry, Tony.
Go ahead.
Siobhan, when someone, you mentioned, you know, when they're first rescued, when they first come out, as a therapist, what's the first thing you begin working on with them? What's the hardest, what's the first baby step that they'll take after, all right, I'm out, I recognize it, or they were pulled out, saved, whatever it is, that you as a therapist start working on to start re-acclimating them to, and man, I wrote this one down, to get them to start thinking again because they tried to not think for so long.
Yeah. Usually if they're open to coming to a therapist, they're thinking, you know, right. they've started, they're trying to make sense of it. They've got a lot of trauma to talk through. And I just really encourage them to feel their feelings, because that's one of these things these groups do, is they repress, they teach you to repress. And you're supposed to be joyful all the time. And you're supposed to always smile and tell the world, I love everybody. You know, there's just this script that they've been taught to follow. It's not real. And by the time they come to therapy, they're realizing that they've been sold a bill of goods. And so I just want them to start being honest. Often it's helpful to keep a journal, do writing. Your feelings are valid. Your feelings are there for a reason. Let's help you feel what they are. And then the questions come, and then we can sort through the questions. And as they start to feel their real feelings and talk about their history and talk about, you know, we can talk about what was good about this experience, what was not so good about this experience. And usually there's a long laundry list about what was not so good about it. And because of my background, I can understand that. I never want to make them feel stupid, you know, because people can easily get sucked into this stuff.
You're such a gift. Thank you.
Oh, so
that time period where you didn't talk about your religious trauma and everything, we're talking about it, you know, obviously a different time period. And I think things have changed. We're in a society now where people can be far more open about their religious trauma and experiences, but we still do have a stigma to it from people who are not necessarily in a cult, but for example, folks who belong to the local Catholic church, folks mm-hmm. who are at the Lutheran mm-hmm. church, folks mm-hmm. who are at the ones that are not necessarily considered cults per se, folks who are just, you know, everyday, Christian religious type folks.
Yep.
You bring up something like the Duggars. You bring up something like your experiences. And they have very little information and understanding of a lot of extreme religious behavior. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the first thing that comes out of their mouth when you bring up some sort of religious trauma is they don't want to judge it. They don't want to even talk about it because, that's God's, you know, they immediately go to offense. And mm-hmm. and so many people do. They go to offense and defend God, and because they take even just this, the inclination that somebody could be abusing the word of God mm-hmm. as like, oh, that's impossible, even though the Bible talks about it all mm-hmm. over the place of like, mm-hmm. there's going to be people that bastardize this, everybody look out for it.
Yes.
And then when people are like, hey, here's something to look out for. Oh no, that couldn't be possible because they have a cross on their neck.
Right.
It's like, yeah, that's a red flag right there for some folks. How much of that, how much of the societal unacceptance of hearing you out, hearing your story, held you back from sharing your story just because it's exhausting to have to re-explain the details of what you went through to people who just don't, they don't even want to hear it because it challenges or it might challenge their way of thinking. That to me is an interesting aspect to all of this.
Yeah, and I think you're hitting the nail on the head. It's important to emphasize that not all Christian groups are cults.
Mm-hmm.
Not all Buddhist groups are cults. It's a very distinct type of organization. It's a closed system. And the key thing for me is, does your faith make your life better? Does it help you? Does it comfort you? Does it help you grow? Or is it shutting you down and causing psychological harm? And there's a distinct difference mm-hmm. in those groups. And there are these fringe, closed off from society, us versus them. Everybody else has it wrong and is going to hell. And then there are churches that do wonderful work and people that are devout Christians, but they really do try to model their lives after Jesus, you know, who was a very loving figure.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't ever want people to feel like I'm knocking their faith. And I try very hard never to do that with clients, but there are very different ways of being a person of faith and very different ways that churches manifest.
It's funny. I keep going back to the behaviors of trust that I'm always trying to exhibit, and I'm always looking for others, both individually as well as groups, whether it's a religious group or an organization that is open, honest communication. Transparency, and vulnerability. Vulnerability means you own up to a mistake, a transgression, and you have a self-correcting thing in place to get better, overcome it, acknowledge it, and grow. Mm-hmm. And so if those three pillars are in place, it's most likely a place where you can have a healthy engagement, whatever mm-hmm. it's political or religious or anything like that. Because to your point, Siobhan, if it brings joy, happiness, and healthy relationships, it's a good thing for our lives.
Good
and again,
thing.
Transparency, mm-hmm. transparency, transparency, yes. transparency. If there's any aspect of what you're part of or a group you're part of that says you can't share, that's a massive red flag.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
1,000%. Wonderful conversation, as always, everybody. Siobhan's book, Nightbird, available wherever you get books. Go check it out. Amazing survival story here. And Robin's latest book, available as well. It's Not All About Me, also available wherever books are sold. Go and check them out. All right, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. Until next time, for Robin, Siobhan, and Todd, I am Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.